I'm a shot in the dark, wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go. Episode 181. Wow. So I have... I've had you guys on this continuing tech journey with me, and as you can probably tell the last few episodes, things sound a lot richer and a little better. And as I talked about on the last show, I finally just broke down and I bit the bullet and bought real mics and a real setup. And, you know, I thought that I could get away with what I had, but I was wrong. And I'm kind of, you know, but it's funny though. So the last episode, I was holding the microphone and I noticed it was just so strange because it made me feel very different. I felt like I was hosting a variety show or something. I don't know what I was doing, but, I've recorded in the studio at the Institute where I work sometimes. And they have one of the big, you know, if you've ever seen pictures of someone recording radio, that they have like a mic on the end of a big arm, you know? So I finally just got I thought those things were like really expensive. Turns out they're like $20. So I bought me an arm for my desk. So now I have a bona fide real, at least it's shaped like a real radio setup. Which is interesting because now I'm in a different mode. I'm in the broadcaster commentator mode because I'm sitting at this chair. I'm not hunched over. I have to stay in one position, but a little bit. But you know, I'm going to be honest with you. I used to have a headset, and I'm going to look into see if they have this level of microphone built into a headset. I like to be in motion while I'm talking, and it's just something to get used to. But so here we are on episode 181. I stand in astonishment that I've done 181 of anything, as always. Oh, hey, another good thing about this setup is, hey, listen to this. Watch. I could take a drink of coffee, but I can turn away from the microphone because it's not attached to my head. So, you know, it's 6 of 1, half dozen of the other. And you could probably still hear me take a drink of coffee, but I won't be slurping in your ear anymore quite as bad, I don't think. So it's the little things in this world. So yeah, so I'm really happy. I'm really happy that I have the ability to make something that sounds so much more real now. So, which is now, I think I'm going to finally get around to launching the Calyx podcast now. Or at least putting some audio up on the Calyx website, pontificating about the geekery of coffee and using coffee houses to reach people and all that. So there's stuff that is specific enough that it would bore most of you to tears. And so if you're not into that exact thing, pardon me. Hey, I could sneeze too. If I end up sneezing, I could just turn far away from the microphone. There's a lot of, this microphone is just going to open up whole new vistas of possibility here. No sneezing, no slurping here. Let's experience that quieter slurp one more time. Here we go. Cause I need some coffee. Oh, that is amazing. I mean, this is like what they've managed to do. They could put a man on the moon and now they can get me to do a podcast or a radio show or some kind of recording and not slurp in your ear. And I can still drink coffee during the show. This is probably the most boring chatty first segment you've ever heard, isn't it? Oh, so yeah. So I'm made the next step towards big boy when it comes to my tech. So, So we're, 3/4 of the way through the intensive classes where I work. I got about 50 to 70 extra people on campus right now. So it's been fun. The shop, you know, we normally run kind of single coverage except for just over lunch. And with this added, this increase in business, you know, we've had to run double coverage all day, which is hard with a staff our size. I shout out to everyone who works at Tole Leje for taking some extra hours and making it happen this week. But it's kind of fun. It's like, instead of just being alone when it's slow and kind of working on your computer, cleaning it by yourself, there's kind of, this feels more like a real shop. It's like, you know, you're actually, you know, I don't have to take a bunch of orders. I can just make some coffee. Someone else is taking orders and stuff. And so that workflow is something that I really, really enjoy. And I didn't realize how much I missed it. I think I want to get that shop a lot busier so we can double up all those shifts. But so that's been fun. I met a lot of really interesting people. I interviewed Lavinia Spirito on the show a couple episodes ago, and just met her randomly over the bar. Another Breadbox Media host happened to be in the graduate school class that is in the institute where my shop is. What are the chances, you know? So funny. So it's been interesting. The Christ in the City kids have been in all week taking a class, and I've been through two or three crops of Christ in the City missionaries, a couple of crops at least, and that's where we send a lot of our leftover food and stuff. If you're not familiar with Christ in the City, I would really suggest you look it up. It's a young people right out of college that go and spend a couple of years living in community and working with the homeless, and they're just really great kids. I'm a giant fan of all of them, and this crop is getting to the end of their missionary time, and so it's so cool to hear what they're going off to do. Some of them are coming to our school. One of them's even interested in coming to work in the shop. But they've been in all week, and I normally get to see them just kind of for a little while on Thursdays when they were taking a class. But it's been fun to have them like in the shop every day, taking this class. So. And just different people from all over the country, you know, it's a good time. I really like just kind of getting to meet some new people, new faces. And over the course of a week, when you make coffee for someone 2-3 times a day and, you know, sell them some lunch and stuff, just that little bit of small talk, it really reminded me how much influence you can have, how much real connection you can have in the life of a quote unquote regular in a coffee house. If you get someone who's a regular, someone who comes in and gets coffee most days, then over the course of a year, I mean, you have a lot of really serious time with them. If you add up all the time, and people usually get, you know, one or two of the same drink, they have a usual. So there's the regular, and they come in and they get their usual, and it's interesting. So then when someone comes in, you don't have to explain anything to them. You're not even talking about the coffee. You just go, you see them walking in the door and you're like, hey, the usual. Yeah. And you'll be 322. Yeah. Thanks, man. Hey, how you been? Yeah. Good. And you're just sitting there chatting with them over the course of a cappuccino. And I've seen time and time again, and this is an example that I use with Calyx, is that in the space of 15 to 40 cappuccinos, you can really build. I would say a version of real friendship with someone. You can get to know who they are. They can get to know you. And you can, in 15 to 40 cappuccinos, you can earn the right to be heard. And I think that comes down to the core of Calyx and what I do with my apostolate is people that would never walk in a church, you give them in a community, you bring them into a community in a type of interaction where it's perfectly normal. And then you, over time, earn the right to be heard. And that's what we do in all of our lives, right? I mean, that's what friendship is. Over time, here's some guy. Maybe you have something in common with him. Maybe you don't. But you're forced into a situation. Maybe at first you don't even like the guy. But maybe he's dating a friend of yours. And you're like, okay, she likes him. I like her. There must be something about this guy. And, you know, over the course of cocktail parties and going to dinner, bumping into him at the park or whatever, you just get to know the guy. Right? And you kind of come around, okay, he's kind of a weird dude, but I like that guy. You know, and then at some point he brings up something worthwhile, politics or something like that. And you're like, okay, you know, you've gotten to the point where you're like, you're willing, you know this guy, you know who he is. You've kind of got a feel for kind of how he got there. And you're willing to listen, right? You're willing to have a conversation with him. And that's the same thing. That's what we do. And I guess this is an intensive week when we have all these new people in. It's kind of a moment where I get to see that in a snapshot of that. Kind of like I get to see that writ large, you know? And so that's been fun. It's a good time. I dig it. And yeah, so that's it's busy as all heck though. It's not one of those weeks where you have a whole ton of time to reflect on things. So not too much interest. Oh, I take that back. Something I didn't even read the news this morning. I don't know. I haven't seen anything. I watched the news all day. I don't know what happened with the sit-in. I guess the last I heard, the Democrats were sitting in Congress, and there was a big sit-in, and Paul Ryan was about to call the security to come and take them out. So I guess I should get online and figure out what in the world happened with that. But that was some high drama, but it was just all kabuki. It's always kabuki. I'm not interested in kabuki. You know, Clinton came out and lied about a bunch of stuff, and then Trump came and said she was a liar, but he's a tyrant too. So I don't know. I've really almost checked out of this political race so far. So I'm just, yeah, doesn't seem like too much else interesting happened. I take that back. Something else interesting did happen, and I'm just going to reflect on this for a moment. The Cardinals swept the Cubs. I mean, so I work in an institute with a ton of Cubs fans, but the founder of the institute is a Cardinals fan, as am I. And you know, when you have a team consistently as good as the St. Louis Cardinals, I mean, you just I don't even follow them, because it's just, they're always good. How are the Cardinals doing? Oh, they're pretty good. They're going to either be really great or pretty good. I mean, it's like it just doesn't go anywhere else. that's for my local friends that listen to the show that I give crap about the Cubs all the time. All right, so let's go to the break, and we'll come back with something more serious and fun. You're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. Thanks for coming out.
I'm a sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Let me skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. Only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so I was reading Lorenzo Albacete's book, God at the Ritz, last night. Now, if you're not familiar with Lorenzo Albacete, you absolutely have to get familiar with Lorenzo Albacete. If nothing else, go on YouTube and find his debate, if you can call it that, with Christopher Hitchens. It is like Lorenzo Albacete, Monsignor Lorenzo Albacete. Hold on, coffee. Albacete is he just passed recently. He is this old Puerto Rican Monsignor who used to be the president of the University of Puerto Rico. I think he helped found the JP2 Institute here in America. And he was a close friend of Monsignor Luigi Giussani, and he is kind of the godfather. He was the godfather of communion and liberation, the movement that I'm kind of involved in. And he's absolutely hilarious. I think the most interesting interview I have ever seen in my entire life was Lorenzo Albacete interviewing Cardinal Sean O'Malley at the New York encounter a couple years ago. And the form that this interview took, if you could call it that, was Lorenzo would basically just tell lies about Cardinal O'Malley, or he'd just exaggerate something completely out of context. And then the way the story would get told would be O'Malley basically defending himself, and then telling the real story behind it. It's like O'Malley's a Franciscan, and he's like, yeah, this guy is a Franciscan. I don't know. He has this, he owns these buildings. He owns this huge building in Washington, D.C. I didn't know the Franciscans were allowed to own anything. They have this huge building. Tell him about how you bought the building. He goes, okay, look. Anyway, you explain what their institute did or what their work was working with the homeless, and someone gave them a building for a dollar. So yes, he technically bought the building, but it wasn't his. And you end up with this whole cool story about this building, but it started, Lorenzo would just sit there with a straight face and just tell a lie about O'Malley. It was really, really spectacular. But when Lorenzo died, there was a man wrote an article, I think it was in the New York Times, kind of, and he had a guy had been away from the church for a long time. He wasn't a big time Catholic, but he was a professional server, and he'd waited on Monsignor Albacete several times. And he said, "You know what? I'm around a lot of clerics, and they come in, and I wait on them, and I don't know a lot of these guys, and they always have all the answers." He goes, "The thing I'll say about Lorenzo is, he always had all the, he was the one that always had the best questions in the room." And I think that that's something to aspire to. So his book, God at the Ritz, is a really spectacular book. And it's really, he really has translated into writing kind of the feel of the humor and the turns of phrase and the way he thinks about things. And I just picked it back up last night and started reading it. And he talks about something I think is fascinating. He says that, you know, these archaeologists and these paleontologists, you know, they're always digging up. They find these caves, right? And they get this cave. They go in the cave, and it's really old. And it's always older than we thought humanity was doing anything that they would do in caves, you know, like painting or something. And they always find another one, and they keep pushing this date back about how long our species has been around and what we've been doing. And so he says, but every time you go into one of these caves, there's always, they always find it. There it is. The painting of the bull on the side. There's always this bull. And they've all agreed this is some kind of a religious thing. And they'll find a new cave. And it's, you know, several hundred thousand years older than the last cave they found. And they dig around, and there's the bull. It's always like they paint this animal on the wall. It's usually like a big old bull. Kind of, is he flying? Is he charging? What is he doing? Right. And he says that whoever drew the first bull, that man should be hailed as like the greatest religious leader in the history of mankind. Because I mean, this man's cult, this bull's cult, is millions of years old. They're just find a million year old cave. There's the bull. They find a cave from a few hundred thousand years ago. There's the bull. He says this bull is that. Now, what he ends up saying is that that bull is a symbol of the what Monsignor Giuzzani would call the religious sense, right? It is this intense spiritual longing. It is a sense. It is something that we feel inside of us, and it has an object. It's an internal longing directed to an object, and the object is something that is not that is above matter, that it's above energy, it's above all this. And I've done whole shows on longing. I've talked about longing, but I wanted to talk about this innate, just think about that. You don't find a civilization. In fact, it's funny. We mark a civilization by how far they've advanced, how far they've evolved. When we're looking at these old ruins and we're looking at, you know, by what they do with the religion, we look at them, you know, in fact, the, one of the big marks of a civilization, progressing beyond just kind of being primitive and animalistic is they do something different with their dead. Right. They have some place. They just found a cache of bodies down in somewhere down South America, I think it was, where it was just it was a mass grave. It was like a big hole that they would basically go like throw these people down in. But it was, they've been doing it for forever. And it was they took their dead and put them someplace particular. You know, when you see a civilization, you know, and they do some kind of, when you find these bodies buried, you know, they find mummies or something, and they've preserved them in some way. They've wrapped them. They've put things with them. They've done something. This is a sign that a culture has progressed to the point that they want to, they understand that this world isn't it. that there's something beyond this. There's something more, that there's something where this contingent turns into something else. It gets taken up into something higher. Now, these are obviously very, you know, you look at like Egyptian tombs or whatever, they think that they give them chairs and gold and food and wine and all this stuff because they think that they're going on a journey. They need all this stuff with them. They, you know, so this isn't just a either or, you cross the line and now you're in those who know, you understand. It's not, it doesn't work like that. But it's a trajectory. It's a direction we move towards. And I think that that trajectory, I don't know which comes first, the changing of how we deal with our dead, or the painting of the bull on the wall, you know. But he has a great, this is all in chapter one, that some of this is in chapter one of God at the Ritz. And he says that if Flannery O'Connor, he talks about how you find these magazines in the airport, you know, and these journals and stuff that he reads and he keeps up on this archaeology. And what, this is a guy, this guy was like an astrophysicist before he became a priest. He's like a really intelligent guy. He's usually the smartest guy in the room. And he's like the funniest with the most questions most of the time. But he says that, you know, he says he thinks that they're going to dig up airports, you know, in a few thousand years and see what our civilization was like. And he's going to think we worship chickens. Because we look at chicken soup as the lens for everything. There's chicken soup for the soul, chicken soup for the dog lover soul. And he talks about all these chicken soup books. He's like, they're going to think we advance from the bull to worshiping the chicken, you know. But he uses that turn of phrase to talk about how Flannery O'Connor said that we'd become a generation of wingless chickens, you know. And I think that's a great line because the way Albacete talks about it is like, you know, we've never been able really to soar like eagles, you know, but we could hop up and down, you know, we could, you know, and we could even roost, you know, if you've been around chickens, they do fly. I mean, they don't fly far, but they do go up and down, you know? And he says that we've become a generation like the two-dimensional figures in that novel Flatland. We've had our wings clipped and now we can just go side to side and front and back. We've lost that vertical dimension, right? We could never soar, but we used to at least try to hop up and down. And that is the spiritual life, so to speak, is just, you know, you struggle and you kind of try to get a little higher up and then you come back down, you know, but you're struggling to escape this two-dimensional space, right? It's a really good image of it. So anyway, there's a one segment book report on the first chapter of Lorenzo Albacete, God at the Ritz. It's really a spectacular book. I cannot recommend anything. I would just go to YouTube and watch everything you can find that Lorenzo Albacete ever said. It just all the interviews and there's probably a New York Encounter. That New York Encounter interview is probably on the New York Encounter page. Or somewhere on their YouTube channel or Vimeo. I mean, just, I never come away having listened to or read Lorenzo Albacete without coming away with something, you know? Hey, speaking of reading things, shout out to my little cousin, Tyler, who, a friend of his on Facebook was, asking for, audiobooks or podcasts to listen to. And he recommended C.S. Lewis's The Space Trilogy and The Counterposition. Man, I hope she finds a better episode than this one to start with. Because unless you're used to my little chatty banter, that first segment was probably just boring as I'll get out of talking about my technology. But unless you're following along with my crazy adventures. Yeah, but man, to be grouped with Lewis in the same sentence, my goodness. I tell you what, I love The Space Trilogy too. Maybe we'll talk about the Space Trilogy when we get back. So let's go to the break. You're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. Thanks for coming up.
Then how we crave a hanging and it's dark.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
People singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. I'm telling you, having this big old mic with a foam ball on the end of it, on the like right up in my face, it changes what I do. Like usually when I'm doing the show, I've got this headset on, this little mic that moves with me, so I'm more mobile. I'm moving around. I have a computer screen up that I can see, and I'm looking at notes. I'm writing myself little notes. I'm looking something up that I can't find and going, "What was that thing? Oh yeah, there it is." You know, I'm very mobile. You know, I'm multitasking and finding things that I want to talk about as I'm talking about them to you. So this is a little different ballgame. I'm kind of stationary. I'm not as stationary as I was when I was holding the microphone and having to like not move, but it's interesting. You get the insight into I've always been pretty open about what it's like to do this thing. You know, when you start trying to put your face in a microphone 5 days a week and say something to somebody might find interesting. We're just about a year. I mean, we're coming up on a year of the Counterposition. This thing has been, when I think back on the Counterposition, it's almost like it's a relationship. This is the longest relationship I've had in a really long time is with this radio show. It's interesting. It's like, you got to think of something to tell the microphone every day. It's like I've seen this one friend and it's you, but I've talked to this one friend every day, you know, for a long time. It's an interesting thing. You know, it got me thinking about, just now when we were talking about, what people do with their dead. A friend of mine, that I went to college with briefly, I can't remember the guy's last name. It's Father Foddy. And, Foddy, was really good friends with a bunch of people I'm good friends with. We didn't really hang out that much. We're still even trying to figure out if we were at the school for very long at the same time. But he's in town, being a chaplain for this intensive class, you know? And so, man, he gave a sermon the other day that I just thought was like one of the best sermons I'd heard in a long time. And he, really short daily mass sermon, quick, concise, to the point, dare I say, Rylian. Shout out to Father John Riley, who I'm sure doesn't even own a way to listen to this show. He left us, went out to the desert to live a Franciscan life, and I think he is thrown off the shackles of the kind of life where he would sit around listening to a guy like me. He's too busy out there probably having mystical experiences of working with the poor out in the desert or something. But he just had a really great way of doing a very concise, quick, but really meaty daily homily, you know. And so Father Foddy tells this story that I think is just spectacular. And if I get my historical facts wrong, I am an absolute idiot when it comes to history, anything remotely in the modern world. I don't have the basic understanding. I'm sure I read it all at one point, but now I've kind of gotten interested in it. I've been thinking about maybe going back and starting to read books about World War II, World War I, world history, and kind of like, you know, how the continent shaped in the last couple hundred years and stuff. It just all went right over my head when I was a kid. But, so if I make mistakes, you know, just mea culpa, have mercy on me. You know, I just wasn't, that's just not what I read, and I don't know much about it. So, but this is a story about Otto von Habsburg. And, when he died, you know, this guy, he's he's pretty much like the last official kind of like the living kind of vestige of that big, you know, the Holy Roman Empire and all that. And so, I mean, I remember walking around Vienna with him. I just had no idea. This is part of what sparked my interest in this history stuff now, is I was walking around Vienna with Pater Edmund Wallstein, who I did go to college with, who's a Cistercian monk. His dad is Michael Wallstein, and who is co-founded the International Theological Institute. He's the translator of that theology of the body that everyone uses now, man and woman, he created them. He's an incredible scholar and a member of Communion Liberation too. really incredible guy. And his son is a Cistercian monk at, I can never say this German word, Heiligenkreuz. Heiligenkreuz, it means Holy Cross. It's a beautiful monastery just southeast of Vienna. But my Viennese geography is pretty bad. I was just always on a train going through some city when I was there. Their family is kind of an offshoot of the Habsburgs. I think that Mihail, if the old lineage, the old titles were still in line, I think Mihail is like 20th in line for the seat of the Holy Roman Empire at the moment. It's like, so they're, we walked through the city, and it's funny because in Vienna, they're always, there's always people running around dressed like Mozart and all this stuff. And they're kind of playing up on the tourist thing, and people dressed in period dress walking around promoting certain events and everything. And I'm walking around with Potter Edmund, who is wearing a traditional Cistercian habit and a big long kind of a cape, a traditional kind of black woolen cape over the top of it because it was cold and raining. And we're walking around Vienna, and I'm equally getting like the, oh, here, this used to be the Winter Palace of, you know, so-and-so and this, and that's the best sausage stand in the city over there. And hey, you see those stairs right there by the operas? That's that final scene in Before Sunrise, that Linklater film. I mean, he's like giving me that. We're just like walking around Vienna. And people are mistaking him as having dressed up. They're asking him like what he's promoting. Like, oh, are they doing a thing? And no, this is like, I'm still taking part in that, the worldview that built this civilization. This isn't like a costume. This is my clothes, you know. He's like walking around as a monk because he is a monk. He's a Cistercian monk, right? And so we went through the National Archives there, and he just showed me everything. And it's so funny. He was speaking of all of this in the way that someone would show you their family pictures. Because, you know, this ceremonial cope, this staff made out of narwhal horn or whatever, this set of gloves that the person would put on once a year when they did the whatever, you know, it was fascinating. Because, I mean, these are his forebears, you know, he's in that family line, right? So, anyways, when Otto von Habsburg dies, people come from all over the world. There's all these world leaders and all this stuff. And they process through the streets, and they go to the Franciscan church, the Franciscan Kirk, they call it. And they get up to the door. This is the main story. Just Otto von Habsburg. I'm not even going to try to be right about exactly who he was or when he died. Just Habsburg. Otto von Habsburg. And they go up to the door, and they strike the door. And a voice comes from the other side and says, he says, who seeks entry or who requests entry or whatever. And they say, Otto von Habsburg. And then they list all of his political titles and achievements and, you know, this huge long list of titles. I mean, it was because, I mean, if you were in that seat, you had like all, you were the count of so-and-so, the duke of this, he's had all this stuff. Right. And the voice comes back from the other side. We do not know him. And they wait a bit, and they strike the door again. The voice comes from the other side. Who seeks entry? And they say, Otto von Habsburg. And they list all of his religious titles. He's this and this and this. And they list all this long titles and all these accomplishments and all this, these accolades and all this stuff of who Otto von Habsburg is. And the voice comes from the other side. We do not know him. And they wait, and then they strike the door a third time. And he says, who requests entry? And they say, Otto, a miserable sinner in search of grace. Or a miserable sinner needing mercy. And the door opens, and he says, as such, he may enter. You know, this was all a commentary on the gospel the other day about the narrow path, the narrow way, right? And he compared the narrow ways. He says the way is narrow for a reason, right? He says it's because you can't be big and get through it. You know, it's funny. There's a pulpit myth from American evangelical charismatic theology that is that there's the eye of the needle gate, You know, where Christ said it's easier for the camel to go through an eye of the needle than it is for a rich man to get into heaven. And the myth is there's this really small gate and you could get a camel through it, but you had to unload everything off of it and you had to get it on its knees to get through. Now, it turns out there was no such gate. Christ really is a little skeptical about people having a lot of stuff. But there is kind of something symbolic about that, you know, and that's ultimately what purgatory is, right? And that's what our purgation here is, where we slowly put everything down, right? We're putting things down and making ourselves smaller, you know, so that we don't have anything from this world attached to us, so to speak. You know, St. Francis wants told his followers to be like the little fishes, the little small fishes, because they're too small to get caught by the net. The holes in the net are bigger than the little fish. So they only catch the big fish. So be like the little fishes, because in the net of this world can't snare you. And even someone like Otto von Habsburg has to kind of get everything stripped off, at least symbolically, to make it through that narrow gate, you know? So that's something to reflect on today. It's something to think about. What do you need to put down today? I know I got a lot of stuff I need to put down. You know, we're going to pick up this theme of putting things down and getting ready for your narrow gate when we get back. I've got a couple more ideas about this. So you're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. We'll be right back.
Then all the color glass that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to see. Love decked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely. And I'm done.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so we're talking about putting things down, talking about getting small, talking about making ourselves ready to get through that narrow gate. You know, it just kind of hit me during the break. I was thinking that, you know, you look at maybe that's a full circle kind of thing, the way we treat our dead. You know, you look at that, we start off, we're just animals, basically. We're just like letting wherever they fall, you know, we don't really see that they just stay there, right? You know, like an animal. Then at some point we start taking our dead to a certain place. Then we start doing stuff to them. And the height of this is when you see this incredible preservation in, you know, like the Egyptian pyramids and whatnot. And they, especially the more important a person is, the more stuff they tack onto them and put with them. And these burial chambers are just like, they're 15 times nicer than the average person's home. I mean, this had everything, more stuff than the average peasant had owned in their entire life would just be brand new put into this burial chamber to go with this important person into the afterlife, right? And it's funny, maybe in some ways I'd defend the more primitive people to just let them stay where they lay, because at least then they realize that the idea is to be small and to be stripped, and it's not to be, you can't take anything with you. It's not about tacking stuff on, it's about taking stuff off, you know. And it's funny, I've said before, you know, in conversation, I probably said it on the show at some point, because this is how I treat this. This is like my side of a conversation. And I feel like in my life, I feel like I don't want to put down my cross. I want to carry my cross. You know, Christ said, if you would follow me, you take up, you know, if you want to have the kingdom of God, you have to pick up your cross and follow me. So we all have a cross. And you have to carry that one. You know, there's an old story about an old tale. It's kind of a joke about this guy that he goes to St. Peter and he's like, hey, I'd like to trade this cross in. Like, what's wrong? He goes, well, it's just too heavy. I just can't carry this cross. All right, well, just set it over there and pick another one. So he tries a couple on. He takes one, brings it back. He goes, no, this one isn't right. This is way too bad, heavy. And so he tries a few out, tries six or seven different crosses out, and they're all way too much. And finally, he picks up this cross, and he's like, oh, this one's perfect. And he carries it. And he's like, and as he's walking out the door, St. Peter says, you know, you realize that was your original cross. It's like there's something about, you know, the thing that we have to drag around in this world that we have to deal with that is kind of designed to strip us, to keep us from going too far. It's just heavy enough to get us where we need to go, but not to where we can't go too far. It's gonna strengthen us in a way that we need to be strengthened to become ourselves, right? And so you don't want to put your cross down. I feel like a prayer that has emerged in me in the last couple of years has been that I want to put everything but my cross down. Because I feel like I've got my cross and I've got like a messenger bag and a backpack and like a roller bag, like with another thing attached to it, and like a little red wagon full of bricks. And I'm just dragging all this stuff along with me. And I blame it all on my cross. I'm like, man, this cross is just too heavy. And it's like, actually, if you would just put all the stuff down that I didn't ask you to carry, your cross is actually pretty light. I mean, you won't even notice it if you will just put down all this other crap, you know? I think that's where I'm at, is I just want to put down everything else, you know? And then I think it's, I think that we see, how to say it, you know, I've been reflecting on something here, and y'all probably get more out of me on this because this is kind of something that's huge in my life right now. So, there's these things that we become, and maybe we become them just by nature, just by who we are, nurture, kind of how we're raised and how we get affection, how we get responses out of people or whatever, you know. Maybe we're hurt and this is how we deal with it, and it becomes a pattern or something like that, you know, these different things that happen to us. For me, and I was just talking to my friend Perry about this last night. For me, I talk a lot. All the time. I'm a talker. We say, I always have been. My dad used to yell at me about it. My mom, they say about my mom, they'll say, and they say it about me. If you ask me what time it is, I will tell you how to build a clock. I've always been a talker. I just talk a lot. And it's funny. It's, part in my modern life, in my adult life, from my 20s on, it's really kind of, I think out loud. I always have. When if I'm by myself, I do this show in my car when you're not listening. I'm not quite this organized, but I think out loud sometimes. I mean, I process out loud, you know? So it's funny. There's just recently over the weekend, I had a conversation with a friend, and I was kind of, you know, made alert that, and this has happened several other times, that I really dominate conversation. When I'm in conversation, it's not too much different than listening to this show. I just talk and talk and talk. And people put up with it because they love me. And some people like it at times. I mean, I can be kind of funny and charming and it's interesting. I've pushed away all the people that can't stand that, and the people that kind of like, well, I mean, I dig it sometimes, but we put up with it because we love him. Those are my friends now, right? But it's funny. I was just talking to Perry last night, and I was like, you know what? I think that this is, it's kind of like when you watch, maybe it's why I like superhero stuff so much, is these people over time, they develop, it emerges, and then it develops, and they have this superpower, right? They can make, you know, lasers shoot out of their eyes or whatever. And they all of them, like when you watch like young X-Men or something like that, they always go through this phase where they've got this fire hose of power, but they can't control it. Right. And, you know, I walked around for a couple of days over the weekend, partially just because of, you know, this conversation I had with a friend, and they kind of called me on this. And then I was thinking about having to call my dad, and it just, you know, I really got down on myself over the weekend. I was really, really, really down. You know, and if you haven't listened to the show before, sometimes I get really personal on this show. So this is kind of me bearing my soul a little bit here. And, you know, I was really down over the weekend. I was just like, and over the first part of this week, I was just like, man, I've just become this person. I don't know how it happened, but I can't shut it off. You know, I think out loud. And so I just talk and talk and talk, and it just pushes people away, you know? And I got to thinking about it. It's like, it's interesting. All the stuff that happened to me when I was a kid that made me kind of become this kind of person, and how it developed over time, and the different things that have happened to me in my life that have encouraged this, and I've continued on, and all this stuff. It's funny. Then I get to working in coffee bars in my early 20s, you know? And so you only get a snapshot of someone. So you want to know what I'm like behind the bar? Listen to this show. Someone comes in, and we've talked about, hey, what's been going on? What are you reading or anything? You know, I was reading Lorenzo Albacete last night. Really? What's that about? You know, he was talking about this bowl. You know how they always find a bowl on the wall? And I'll just do the little 2-3 minutes of this show while I'm making coffee, and they're kind of throwing comments back and forth, and then they leave, right? And then I may tell that story 4, 5, 6 times over the course of a day, but you only get a coffee's worth of it, right? And so I realize that I've kind of developed this mode of communication from behind the bar. And that's why the show is called The Counter Position, because it's my position on the world, which is behind the counter. So make pulling shots, talking to strangers, you know, and talking to regulars. And so I realized that that's kind of like become my mode of communication, right? And so it's interesting, because I guess what I wanted to say is that it's funny. It's like you have this thing that is kind of who you are, and then it gets a little extreme to the point that it maybe gets a little toxic. You just can't really control that, right? And then something comes along like this show. Someone comes along and says, hey, that thing you do, I mean, it happened with me with my how I ended up doing this storytelling thing that I do when I speak at conferences and stuff, when I do the story, The Broken Boy, that I wrote. It would just happen on an airplane. I just was telling someone about a screenplay I was trying to write, and they said, that's a cool story, come tell it. Right? So someone comes along and goes, hey, that thing you do naturally that you don't know is a thing, hey, come do that. And that's how I ended up with The Counter Position. You know, that's how I ended up doing this thing that I do that some of you listen to and enjoy. Well, if you're hearing this, you listen to it. I don't know if you enjoy it. And so it's funny. It's like someone comes along and says, hey, that thing that you can do, that's actually a superpower. It's not a fault. It's a superpower, but now you need to learn how to control it. You can't just walk around. You can shoot friggin' lasers from your friggin' eyes, but you can't walk around shooting lasers out of your eyes all the time. You can't do that. You're just going to hurt a bunch of people if you do that. So it's funny. It's like I've become more and more grateful for the counter position, because as I'm trying to kind of, you know, learn how to control the superpower and not overwhelm people in conversation. I love that I have this outlet, you know. I love that you show up and listen. So there you go. So I think it's in this world, there's these things that they may be crosses. They may be just how we're built. They may be things that happen to us. They may be things that we react to the things that happen to us. Maybe people didn't pay attention to you, so you talked all the time, and then you got, you know, felt good because people paid attention or clapped or something when you said a bunch of stuff when you're little. I don't know what the hell happened to me, but, or maybe you can take a experience and reality and turn it into metaphor and write it into a poem or a song, and then people are moved by it. But maybe that came from not being able to say what you wanted to say in any other way. You know, I just think that look at yourself, look at what's going on in your world, look at who you've become, and ask yourself, okay, how is this like a good thing? How is this like a superhero? How is this like a superpower? What would show up that would make sense here, you know? Anyway, that's the end of my shooting lasers out of my eyes for the day. Let's pull the plug to cork on another episode of The Counter Position. Thanks for coming out.
I take your place in my old stone. I take your place in my old stone.